Aroused by the sound of the car as he drove by, she rose up and stretched luxuriously. He let the car roll to a stop in front of the house where he'd lived so long. He blew two blasts on the horn and waited. Nothing. He got out of the car and walked up the steps into the house. Only after he had entered did he think it a little strange that the door was not even locked. Inside, things were in good enough order. He glanced about, apprehensively, but there was nothing at which a man would hesitate to look. He searched around the living room for some note left behind to tell him where they had gone. There was no note. Upstairs, also, everything looked much as usual, but in his parents' bedroom, both the beds were unmade. Perhaps it was that which made him begin to feel giddy and sick. He walked out of the room, feeling himself unsteady. Holding by the rail, he made it downstairs again. The kitchen, he thought, and his mind cleared a trifle at the thought of something definite to do. As he opened the swinging door, the fact of motion within the room struck his senses. Then he saw that it was only the second hand of the electric clock above the sink, steadily moving on past the vertical, beginning its long swoop towards six again. At that moment, also, he started wildly at a sudden noise, only to realize that the motor of the electric refrigerator, as if disturbed by his coming, had begun to whir. In quick reaction, he was deathly ill, and found himself vomiting into the sink. Recovered, he went out again and sat in the car. He was no longer ill, but he felt weak and utterly despondent. If he made a detective-like investigation, searching in cupboards and drawers, he could probably discover something. But of what use thus to torture himself? The main part of the story was clear. There were no bodies in the house. For that, at least, he could be thankful. Neither, he believed, would there be any ghosts, although the faithful clock and refrigerator were rather too ghost-like. Should he go back into the house, or go somewhere else? At first he thought that he could not enter again. Then he realized that just as he had come here, so his father and mother, if by any chance they still lived, would also return here looking for him. After half an hour, overcoming repugnance, he went back into the house. Again he wandered through the empty rooms. They spoke with all the pathos of any dwelling place left without people. Now and then some little thing cried out to him more poignantly. His father's new encyclopedia, purchased with qualms as to the expense, his mother's potted pelargoniums now needing water, the barometer that his father used to tap each morning when he came down to breakfast. Yes, it was a simple house, what you would expect of a man who had taught history in high school and liked books, and of a woman who had made it into a home for him and served on the YWCA board, and of their only child. He always does so well in his studies, for whom they had cherished ambitions and for whose education they had made sacrifices. After a while, he sat down in the living room. Looking at the familiar chairs and pictures and books, he gradually came to feel less despondent. As twilight fell, he realized that he had not eaten since morning. He was not hungry, but his weakness might be partly the result of lack of food. He rummaged around a little and opened a can of soup. He found only the stub of a loaf of bread, and it was moldy. The refrigerator supplied butter and stale cheese. He located crackers in a cupboard. The gas pressure at the kitchen stove was very low, but he managed to warm up the soup. Afterward, he sat on the porch in the dark. In spite of his meal, he felt unsteady, and he realized that he was suffering from shock. San Lupo Drive was high enough on the slope of the hills to be proud of its view. As he sat there looking out, everything seemed just about the same. Apparently, the processes behind the production of electricity must be almost completely automatic. In the hydroelectric plants, the flow of water was still keeping the generators in motion. Moreover, when things had started to go to pieces, someone must have ordered that the streetlights be left turned on. Now he saw beneath him all the intricate pattern of the lights in the East Bay cities, and beyond that, the yellow chains of lights on the Bay Bridge, and still farther through the faint evening mist, the glow of the San Francisco lights, and the fainter chains on the Golden Gate Bridge. Even the traffic lights were still working, changing from green to red. High upon the bridge towers, the flashes silently sent their warnings to airplanes which would no longer ever be flying. Far to the south, however, somewhere in Oakland, there was one holy black section. There, some switch must have failed, or some fuse had burned out. Even the advertising signs, some of them at least, had been left burning. Pathetically, they flashed out their call to buy, though no longer were there any customers left or any salesmen. One great sign in particular, its lower part hidden behind a nearby building, still sent out its message, drink, although he could not see what he was thus commanded to drink. He watched it, half fascinated. Drink. Blackness. Drink. Blackness. Drink. Well, why not? He thought, and going in, he came out again with a bottle of his father's brandy. Yet the brandy had little bite and brought no satisfaction. I'm probably not the type, he thought, to drink myself to death. He found himself really more interested in watching the sign that still flashed there. Drink, blackness. Drink, blackness. Drink. How long would the lights burn? What would make them go out in the end? What else would continue? What was going to happen to all that man had built up through the centuries and now had left behind him? I suppose, he thought again, I ought to be considering suicide. No, too soon. I am alive, and so others probably are alive. We are just like gas molecules in a near vacuum, circulating around, one unable to make contact with the other. Again, a kind of dullness verging on despair slowly came settling upon him. What if he did live on, eating as a scavenger at all those great supplies of food which were piled up in every storeroom? What if he could live well, and even if he could draw together a few other survivors? What would it all amount to? It would be different if one could pick half a dozen friends for fellow survivors, but this way, they would probably be dull and stupid people, or even vicious ones. He looked out and saw still the great sign flashing far off. Drink, blackness. Drink, blackness. Drink. And again he wondered how long it would keep flashing while there were no more vending machines or salesmen offering whatever it was one was to drink. And from that he thought back to some of the other things he had seen that day, wondering what would happen to the coyote that he'd seen loping along the highway, and what would happen to the cattle and horses standing by the watering trough beneath the slowly revolving spokes of the windmill. How long indeed would the windmill still revolve and pump its water from the depths of the earth? Then suddenly he gave a quick start, and he realized that he had again a will to live. At least, if he could be no more a participant, he would be a spectator, and a spectator trained to observe what was happening. Even though the curtain had been rung down on man, here was the opening of the greatest of all dramas for a student such as he. During thousands of years, man had impressed himself upon the world. Now man was gone, certainly for a while, perhaps forever. Even if some survivors were left, they would be a long time in again obtaining supremacy. What would happen to the world and its creatures without man? That he was left to see. Chapter 2. Yet after he was in bed, no sleep came to him. As the chilly arms of the summer fog lapped around the house in the darkness, he felt first loneliness, and then fear, and finally panic. He arose from his bed. Wrapping himself in a bathrobe, he sat before the radio, frantically searching the bands. But he heard only far off the rasp and crackle of static, and there was no one. With a sudden thought, he tried the telephone. As he lifted the receiver, he heard the low hum of the clear wire. He dialed desperately a number, any number. In some distant house, he heard the telephone ring, ring again. He waited, thinking of the sound echoing through empty rooms. After it had rung 10 times, he hung up. He tried a second number, and a third, and then no others. Working with a new thought, he rigged up a light with a reflector, and standing on the front porch, high above the city, he sent the flashes into the night. Short, short, short. Long, long, long. Short, short, short. The old call of the SOS, which had gone out so often from despairing men. But there was no reply from all the expanse of the city. After a while, he realized that with all the streetlights still burning, there was too much illumination. His own petty flashing would hardly be noticeable. So he went into the house again. The foggy night sent a chill into him. He turned on the thermostat, and in a moment he heard the whir of the oil burner. With electricity still working and a full tank of fuel oil, there was no trouble. He sat and, after a while, turned out the lights in the house, feeling in some strange way that they were too conspicuous. He let the fog and the darkness wrap him around and conceal him. Still, he felt the fear of loneliness, and as he sat there, he laid the hammer close at hand, ready for grasping if there should be need. A horrible cry broke the darkness. He trembled violently and then realized that it was only the call of a mating cat. The sort of sound which in any night one might have heard now and then, even on decorous San Lupo Drive. The caterwauling rose to a climax, and then the growl of a charging dog cut across it, and the night was silent again. For them, the world of 20,000 years was overthrown. In the kennels, swollen-tongued, they lay dead of thirst. Pointers, collies, poodles, toy Pekingese, tall hounds. The luckier ones, not confined, wandered loose through city and countryside, drinking at the streams, at the fountains, at the goldfish ponds, hunting here and there for what they might find for eating, scurrying after a hen, picking up a squirrel in the park. And gradually, the pangs of hunger breaking down the long centuries of civilization, they drew closer to where the unburied corpses lay. Now no longer would best of breed go for stance and shape of head and markings. Now champion golden lad of Piedmont IV no longer outranked the worst mongrel of the alley. The prize, which was life itself, would go to the one of keenest brain, staunchest limb, and strongest jaw, who could best shape himself to meet the new ways, and who in the old competition of the wilderness could win the means of life. Peaches, the honey-colored spaniel, sat disconsolate, growing weaker with hunger, too stupid to live by craft, too short-legged to live by pursuit of prey. Spot, the children's mongrel pet, had the luck to find a litter of kittens and kill them. Not for fun, but for food. Ned, the wire-haired terrier, who had always enjoyed being on his own and was by nature a tramp, managed to get along fairly well. Bridget, the red setter, shivered and trembled, and now and then howled faintly with a howl that was scarcely more than a moan. Her gentle spirit found no will to live in a world without master or mistress to love. That morning, he worked out a plan. He felt sure that in an urban district of 2 million people, others must be left alive. The solution was obvious. He must find someone, anyone. The problem was how to make contact. First, he set out to walk around the neighborhood in the hope of discovering someone he knew, but around the well-known houses he saw no sign of people. The lawns were parched, the flowers wilting. Returning home, he passed through the little park where he had often played as a boy, climbing the tall rocks. Two of them leaned together at the top to form a kind of little cave, high and narrow. Ish had often played at hiding there. It seemed a natural, primitive refuge place, and he looked into it. There was no one. He walked on across a broad surface of smooth rock that sloped with the hillside. It was pitted with small round holes, marking the places where squaws had once pounded with stone pestles. The world of those Indians passed away, he thought, and now our world that followed theirs has passed too. And am I the only one? After reaching the house again, he got into his car, mapping out in his head a route to cover the city so that few areas would be left out of the sound of the horn. He drove along, hooting the horn about every minute and then waiting, listening for some reply. As he drove, he looked about curiously, appraising what had happened. The streets had an early morning look. Many cars were parked, and there was little disorder. Fires were burning here and there, as he could see by smoke columns. An occasional body lay where the man had finally been overcome, and near one of them he saw two dogs. At one street corner, the body of a man was hanging from the cross arm of a telephone pole, conspicuously labeled with a placard, "Looter." After he had passed this pole, he came to a good-sized business district, and then he noticed, indeed, that there must have been a certain amount of disorder. The big window of a liquor store was broken. As he came to the end of the business district, he blew his horn again in his regular routine. And half a minute later, he started to hear a faint honk from far away. For a moment, he thought that his ears might merely be tricking him. He honked again quickly, and immediately this time, he had a reply. His heart sank. Echo, he thought. But then he honked again, a long and a short, and as he listened carefully, the reply came merely one long. He turned and drove in the direction of the sound, which he estimated must be half a mile away. Having driven three blocks, he honked again and waited. More to the right this time. He turned. Twisting through the streets, he came to a blind end, turned around, and sought another way. He honked, and the reply was closer. Straight ahead this time he went on, overshot, and heard the next reply to the right and behind him. He took another turn and came to a small business district. Cars were parked along the street, but he saw no one. He thought it strange that whoever was signaling back to him did not stand in the street somewhere and wave. He honked, and suddenly the reply was almost at his elbow. He stopped the car, jumped out, and hurried along the sidewalk. In the front seat of a car parked at the curb, he saw a man. Even as he looked, the man collapsed and fell forward on the wheel. The horn, pressed down, emitted a long squawk as the body slipped sideways to the seat. Coming closer, Ish smelled a reek of whiskey. He saw the man with a long, straggly beard, his face bloated and red, obviously in the last stages of passing out. Ish looked around and saw that the liquor store close by was wide open. In sudden anger, Ish shook the yielding body. The man revived a little, opened his eyes, and emitted a kind of grunt which might have meant, "What is it?" Ish shoved the inert body to a sitting position. As he did so, the man's hand fumbled for the half-empty bottle of whiskey which was propped in the corner of the seat. Ish grabbed it, threw it out, and heard it splinter on the curbing. He was filled only with a deep, bitter anger and a sense of horrible irony. Of all the survivors whom he might have found, here was only a poor old drunk, good for nothing more in this world or any other. Then as the man's eyes opened and Ish looked into them, he felt suddenly no more anger, but only a great deep pity. Those eyes had seen too much. There was a fear in them and a horror that could never be told. However gross the bloated body of the drunkard might seem, somewhere, behind it all, lay a sensitive mind, and that mind had seen more than it could endure. Escape and oblivion were all that could remain. They sat there together on the seat. The eyes of the drunken man glanced here and there, hardly under control. Their tragedy seemed to grow only deeper. The breath came raspingly. On sudden impulse, Ish took the inert wrist and felt for the pulse. It was weak and irregular. The man had been drinking, doubtless, for a week. Whether he could last much longer was questionable. "This, then, is it," thought Ish. The survivor might have been a beautiful girl, or a fine, intelligent man, but it was only this drunkard, too far gone for any help. After a while, Ish got out of the car. He went into the liquor store for curiosity. A dead cat, it seemed, lay on the counter, but as he looked, it stirred to life. And he realized that it had merely been lying, after the habit of cats, in such a position that it looked dead. The cat looked at him with a kind of cold effrontery, as the Duchess at the chambermaid. Ish felt uncomfortable, and had to remind himself that this was the way cats had always behaved. The cat seemed contented and looked well fed. Glancing around the shelves, Ish saw what he'd been curious about. The man had not even bothered to pick out the better whiskey. Rotgut had been good enough for his purposes. Coming out, Ish saw that the man had now managed to find another bottle somewhere and was taking a long drink. Ish realized that there was nothing much he could do about it. Still, he wanted to make a last try. He leaned into the window of the car. The man, revived perhaps by his last drink, was a trifle more alert. He looked at Ish, seeming able to focus his eyes, and he smiled rather pathetically. "Hi," he said in a thick drawl. "How are you?" said Ish. "Ah, Barlow," said the man. Ish was trying to make out what the sounds meant. The man gave his pathetic little childlike smile again and repeated a trifle more clearly.
"Ah, nay, Barlow."
Ish half caught it. "Your name's Borello?" he asked. "No, Barlow." The man nodded at the second name, smiled again, and before Ish could do anything, he was taking another drink. Ish felt himself close to tears, far from anger. What difference did a man's name make now? And yet, Mr. Barlow, in his befuddled mind, was trying to make what had been in civilization the first gesture of goodwill. Then, quite gently, Mr. Barlow slumped down on the seat in stupor again, and the whiskey from the unstoppered bottle gurgled out to the floor of the car. Ish hesitated. Should he cast in his lot with Mr. Barlow, get him sobered up and make him reform? From what he knew of alcoholics, he did not think the prospects good. And by staying, he might lose the chance to make contact with some more likely person. "You stay here," He said to the collapsed body on chance that it might still be able to hear, I promise to come back. Having said this, Ish felt he had fulfilled a kind of minimal duty. He had really no hope. The eyes showed that Mr. Barlow had seen too much. The pulse, that he had gone too far. Ish drove away, making note, however, of the location. As for the cats, they had known little more than 5,000 years of man's domination and had always accepted it with reservations. Those unlucky enough to be left penned inside houses soon died of thirst. But those who had been on the outside managed better than the dogs to scramble along one way or another. Their hunting of mice became an industry, not an amusement. They stalked birds now to satisfy the quick pang of hunger. They watched by the mole tunnel in the uncut lawn and by the gopher burrow in the vacant lot. They prowled in the streets and alleys, here and there discovering some garbage can that the rats had not yet looted. They spread outward from the edge of the city, invading the haunts of the quail and the rabbits. There they met with the real wildcat, and the end was quick and sudden, as the stronger inhabitant of the woods tore the city cat to pieces. The sound of the next horn was more lively. Toot, 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 it went. Toot, a toot, 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 toot. No drunk man was handling that one. When he came close to the sound of it, he saw a man and a woman standing there together. They laughed and waved at him. He drove up and got out of the car. The man was a big fellow, dressed flamboyantly in a loud sport coat. The woman was young enough and good-looking in a blousy way. Her mouth was a red blob of lipstick. Her fingers glittered with many rings. Ish took two steps forward and then stopped suddenly. Two is company, and three is a crowd. The man's look was definitely hostile. And now Ish noticed that the right hand was in the bulging side pocket of the sport coat. How are you? Said Ish, halting. Oh, we're doing fine, said the man. The woman merely giggled, but Ish noticed that there was invitation in her smile, and suddenly, more than ever, he sensed danger. Yes, the man went on. Yes, we're doing fine. Plenty to eat, plenty to drink, and lots of... He made an obscene gesture and grinned at the woman. She giggled again, and again Ish saw invitation and sensed danger. He wondered what the woman could have been in the old life. Now she looked merely like a well-to-do prostitute. There were enough diamonds on her fingers to stock a jewelry store. Is anybody else left alive? They looked at each other. The woman giggled again. It seemed to be her only answer. No, said the man. Nobody around here, I guess. He paused and glanced at the woman again. Not now, anyway. Ish looked at the hand, which the man still kept in the side pocket of the coat. He saw the woman move her hips provocatively, and her eyes narrowed a little, as if she said that she would take the victor. The eyes of this couple were not suffering like the eyes of the drunk man. They did not seem to have sensitive minds, and yet perhaps they, too, had suffered more than men and women could stand, and in their own way had gone bad. Suddenly, Ish realized that he was closer to death, perhaps, than he had ever been before. Which way are you going? Said the man, and the import of his words was clear. Oh, just wandering around, said Ish, and the woman giggled. Ish turned and walked toward the car, more than half expecting to be shot in the back. He made it, got into the car, and drove away. He had heard no sounds this time, but as he turned the corner, there she was, standing in the middle of the street, a long-legged teenage girl with stringy blonde hair. She stood, suddenly stopped as a deer stands surprised in a glade. With a quick movement of a shrewd and hunted thing, she leaned forward, squinting against the sun to the windshield, trying to see who was there. Then she turned and ran swiftly, again like a deer. She dodged through a hole in a board fence and was gone. He walked down to the hole in the fence and looked through it, and called again. He had no reply. He half expected there would be at least a mocking laugh from some window, with a flip of a skirt around a corner. And if he had had even as much encouragement as that, he would have continued the pursuit. But there was nothing flirtatious about this one. Perhaps she had had experiences already, and knew that in such times the only safety for a young girl was in quick and final flights. He waited around some minutes, but nothing happened, and so he went on. Again there had been horn signals, but they had stopped before Ish could get to them. He drove around in the vicinity for some minutes, and at last saw an old man coming out of a grocery store, pushing a baby carriage piled high with canned goods and cartons. When Ish came closer, he saw that the old man was perhaps not so very old. If his scraggly white beard had been shaved away, he might have appeared a vigorous 60. As it was, he was unkempt and dirty, and his clothes looked as if he had been sleeping in them. Of the few whom he had met that day, Ish found the old man most communicative, and yet he too stood off by himself. He took Ish to his house nearby, which he was stocking with all manner of things, some useful, some quite useless. The mere mania of possession had taken command, and the old man was well on the way without restraints toward being the typical hermit and miser. In the former life, Ish learned, the old man had actually been married. He had been a clerk in a hardware store. Yet probably he had always been unhappy and lonely, restricted in his contacts with other people. Now, apparently, he was happier than he had been before, because there was no one to interfere with him, and he could merely withdraw and store up around himself all these material goods. He had canned food, sometimes in neat boxes, sometimes in mere piles and heaps of cans. But he had also had a dozen crates of oranges, more than he could possibly eat before they spoiled. He had beans in cellophane bags, and one of the bags had broken already, spilling the beans across the floor. In addition to food, he had boxes and boxes of electric light bulbs and radio tubes, a cello, though he could not play, a high pile of one issue of the same magazine, a dozen alarm clocks, and a host of other miscellaneous materials which he had collected, not with any definite idea of use, but merely for the comfortable feeling of security which came to him from surrounding himself with all kinds of possessions. The old man was pleasant enough, but he was already, Ish reflected, essentially dead. The shock, reacting upon his already withdrawn character, had sent him close to insanity. He would merely go on piling up things around himself, living to himself, withdrawing farther and farther. Yet when Ish started to leave, the old man seized his arm in panic. "Why did it happen?" he asked wildly. "Why am I spared?" Ish looked in disgust at the suddenly terror-stricken face. The mouth was open, it seemed drooling. "Yes," he snapped back angry and glad to express his anger. "Yes, why were you spared and so many better men taken?" The old man glanced involuntarily about him. His fear was now abject, inhuman.
"That's what I was afraid of," he half-whispered.
Ish reacted into pity. "Oh, come on," he said. "There's nothing to be afraid of. Nobody knows why you survived. You were never bitten by a rattlesnake, were you?
No?
Well, no matter. This business of natural immunity, I believe, nobody understands it. But even in the worst pestilences, not everybody gets sick. But the other shook his head.
I must have been a great sinner, he said.
Well, in that case, you should have been taken.
He?
The old man paused and looked around.
He may be reserving me for something special.
And he shivered. Approaching the toll gates, Ish felt himself automatically begin to wonder whether he had a quarter handy for toll. During a wild second, he imagined himself playing an insane scene in which he slowed the car down and held out an imaginary coin to an imaginary hand stretched out to take it. But though he had to slow the car a little to go through the narrow passageway, he did not stretch out his hand. He had told himself that he would cross to San Francisco and see what things were like there. Once on the bridge, however, he realized that the bridge itself had drawn him. It was the largest and boldest work of man in the whole area. Like all bridges, it was a symbol of unity and security. The thought of going to San Francisco had been an excuse. He had really wished to renew some kind of communion with the symbol of the bridge itself. Now it lay empty. Where six lines of cars had speeded east and west, now the white lines on the pavement stretched off unbroken toward their meeting at infinity. A seagull that was perched on the railing flapped lazily as the sound of the car drew close and slid off on a downward plane. At a whim, he crossed to the left side and drove unobstructed along the wrong lane. He passed through the tunnel, and the high towers and long curves of the suspension bridge rose before his eyes in magnificent perspective. As usual, some painting had been in progress. To contrast with the prevailing silver gray, one cable was splotched with orange red. Then suddenly he saw a strange sight. One car, a little green coupe, was parked neatly at the railing, headed toward the East Bay. Ish approached it, gazing curiously. He saw nobody or nothing inside. He passed it, then yielding to curiosity, he swung his car around in a wide, easy loop and parked beside the coupe. He opened the door and looked in. No, nothing. The driver, despairing, feeling the sickness upon him, had he parked there and then leaped over the railing? Or had he, or she, merely suffered a breakdown and flagged another car or walked on? Some keys were still dangling from the dashboard. The certificate of registration was fastened to the steering column. John S. Robertson of some number on 54th Street, Oakland. An undistinguished name and an undistinguished address. Now Mr. Robertson's car had possession of the bridge. Only after he was again entering the tunnel did Ish think that he might at least have settled the question as to a breakdown by seeing whether he could start the car. But it did not really matter, any more than it mattered that he was heading toward the East Bay again. Having swung around to park beside the coupe, he had merely continued on in the direction toward which he was pointed. He had already realized that there would be no utility in visiting San Francisco. Soon afterward, as he had promised, Ish came again to the street where in the morning he had talked, if it could be called talking, with the drunk man. He found the body lying on the sidewalk in front of the liquor store. After all, Ish reflected, there is a limit to the amount of alcohol that any human can absorb. Remembering the eyes, he could not be sorry. No dogs were in the vicinity as yet, but Ish did not like to leave the body merely lying there. After all, he had known and talked to Mr. Barlow. He could not figure out just where or how he could perform a burial. So he found some blankets in a nearby dry goods store and wrapped the body carefully in these. Then he lifted Mr. Barlow into the seat of the car and closed the windows carefully. It would make a tight and lasting mausoleum. He said no words, for they seemed hardly in place. But he looked through the window at the neat roll of blankets and thought of Mr. Barlow, who was probably a good guy, but couldn't survive a world going to pieces around him. And then, because in some way it seemed a decent thing to do, Ish took off his hat and stood uncovered a few seconds. In that day, as in some ancient time when a great king was overthrown and the remnants of the conquered peoples were jubilant against him, in that day will the fir trees rejoice and the cedars crying out, "Since thou art laid down, no feller is come up against us?" Will the deer and the foxes and the quail exult? Art thou also become weak as we? Art thou become like unto us? Is this the man that made the earth to tremble? Thy pomp is brought down to the grave, and the noise of thy vials. The worm is spread under thee, and the worms cover thee. No. None will say such words, and none will be left to think them, and the book of the prophet Isaiah will molder unread. Only the spike buck will graze farther from the thicket without knowing why, and the fox cubs play beside the dry fountain in the square, and the quail hatch her eggs in the tall grass by the sundial. Toward the end of the day, swinging in a wide detour to avoid one of those noisome regions where the dead bodies lay thickly, Ish came back to the house on San Lupo Drive. He had learned much. The great disaster, so he had begun to call it to himself, had not been complete. Therefore, he did not need immediately to commit his future to the first person he met. He would do better to pick and choose a little, particularly since everyone he had so far seen was obviously suffering from shock. A new idea was shaping in his mind, and a new phrase with it. Secondary kill. Of those that the great disaster had spared, many would fall victim to some trouble from which civilization had previously protected them. With unlimited liquor, they would drink themselves to death. There had been, he guessed, murder. Almost certainly there had been suicide. Some, like the old man, who ordinarily would have lived normal enough lives, would be pushed over the line into insanity by shock and the need of readjustment. Such ones would probably not survive long. Some would meet with accident. Being alone, they would die. Others would die of disease which no one was left to treat. He knew that, biologically speaking, there was a critical point in the numbers of any species. If the numbers were reduced below this point, the species could not recover. Was mankind going to survive? Well, that was one of those interesting points which gave him the will to live. But certainly the result of his day's research gave him little confidence. In fact, if the survivors were typical, who would wish mankind to survive? He had started out in the morning with a Robinson Crusoe feeling that he would welcome any human companionship. He had ended with the certainty that he would rather be alone until he found someone more congenial than the day had offered. The sluttish woman had been the only one who had even seemed to want his company, and there had been treachery and death in her invitation. Even if he found a shotgun and bushwhacked her boyfriend, she could offer only the grossest physical companionship. And at the thought of her, he felt revulsion. As for the other girl, the young one, the only way to make her acquaintance would be by means of a lasso or a bear trap. And like the old man, she would probably turn out to be crazy. No. The great disaster had shown no predilection toward sparing the nice people, and the survivors had not been rendered pleasanter as the result of the ordeal, through which they had passed. He prepared some supper and ate, but without appetite. Afterward, he tried to read, but the words had as little savor as the food. He still thought of Mr. Barlow and the others. In one way or another, each in his own manner, everyone whom he had seen that day was going to pieces. He did not think that he himself was. But was he actually still sane? Was he too perhaps suffering from shock? In calm self-consciousness, he thought about it. After a while, he took pencil and paper, deciding to write down what qualifications he had, why he might be going to live, even with some degree of happiness, while the others were not. First of all, without hesitation, he scribbled, 1. Have will to live. Want to see what will happen in world without man and how. Geographer. Beneath this, he wrote other notes. 2. Always was solitary. Don't have to talk to other people. 3. Have appendix out. 4. Moderately practical, though not mechanical. Camper. 5. Did not suffer devastating experience of living through it all, seeing family, other people, die. Thus escaped worst of shock. He paused, looking at this last note. At least he could hope that it was true. Still, he sat staring and thinking. He could list others of his qualities, such as his being intellectually oriented, and therefore, he supposed, adaptable to new circumstances. He could list that he was a reader, and so had still available an important means of relaxation and escape. At the same time, he was more than a mere reader in that he knew also the means of research through books, and thus possessed a powerful tool for reconstruction. His fingers tightened about the pencil for a moment while he considered writing down that he was not superstitious. This might be important. Otherwise, he would, even now, like the old man, be fighting the fear that the whole disaster had been the work of an angry god, who had now wiped out his people by pestilence as once before by flood, leaving Ish, though as yet unsupplied with wife and children, like another Noah, to repopulate the emptiness. But such thoughts opened up the way to madness. Yes, he realized, if a man began to think of himself as divinely appointed, he was close to thinking of himself as God. And at that point, lay insanity. No, he thought. What happens? At least I shall never believe that I am a god. No, I shall never be a god. Then, his flight of ideas still continuing, he realized that in some ways, very curiously, he felt a new security, and even satisfaction at the contemplation of a solitary life. His worries in the old days had been chiefly about people. The prospect of going to a dance had more than once sent him into a sweat. He had never been a good mixer. No one had asked him to join a fraternity. In the old days, such things were a handicap to a man. Now, he realized, they were actually a great advantage, because he had sat on the edge of so many social gatherings, not quite able to mingle in the conversation, listening, watching objectively. Now he could endure not being able to talk, and again could sit and watch, noting what happened. His weakness had become strength. It was as if there had been a blind man in a world suddenly bereft of light. In that world, those with seeing eyes could only blunder about. But the blind man would be at home. And now instead of being the one who was guided by others, he might be the one to whom the others clung for guidance. Nevertheless, the lonely life stretching out before him did not seem so simple, and seemed far from secure or pleasant, as he again lay on his bed and through the darkness the cold fingers of the fog reached in from the bay and folded within them the house on San Lupo Drive. Then again that great fear came upon him, and he cringed in vague dread, and listened for noises in the darkness, and thought of his loneliness, and of all that might happen to him too in the course of that secondary kill. A wild desire for flight and escape came upon him. He had a feeling that he must go far away and move fast and keep ahead of anything that might be pursuing him. Then he rationalized this thought with the feeling that the disease could not have fallen everywhere upon the United States, that somewhere must be left some community which he should find. Chapter 3. In the morning, his panic had faded, but the deep-seated fear was still with him. He got out of bed carefully and swallowed apprehensively in terror that he might have a sore throat. He handled himself with all the care of an aged hypochondriac. When he walked downstairs, he balanced himself meticulously, realizing that even a sprained ankle might mean death. He immediately began preparations for flight, and as always, when he began acting upon some definite plan, even though the plan in itself made little sense, he felt a quietness and satisfaction. His own car was old. He therefore began to look around for a better one among the many hundreds that were parked along the streets. Most of these were without keys, but finally, in a garage, he found a station wagon which suited his fancy and which contained a key. He pressed the starter, and the engine responded perfectly. He idled it for a minute, raced it, and decided that it was good. He started to engage the gears, and then suddenly paused with a feeling of uneasiness. He did not regret leaving his own car, but still something worried him. In a moment, he remembered. He went back to his old car and took out the hammer. He carried it over to the station wagon and laid it at his feet. Then he drove out of the garage. From a grocery, he stocked himself, nibbling some crackers and cheese for lunch as he walked about selecting his cans. He realized he might pick up supplies at any town. Still, it would be convenient to have a reserve with him in the car. From other stores, he took a sleeping bag, an axe and a shovel, a raincoat, cigarettes, enough food to see him through several days, a small bottle of good brandy. Remembering his experiences of the day before, he went into a sporting goods shop and selected a variety of weapons. A light shotgun, a medium caliber repeating rifle, a small automatic pistol that would go handily into a side pocket, a hunting knife. Just when he had finished loading the station wagon and was about ready to start, he looked around and first became conscious of a dog. He had seen many dogs in the last 2 days, and he had tried to shut them out of his mind. They were pathetic, and he did not like to think about what was happening. Some of them looked starved. Some of them looked too well fed. Some seemed uncertain and cringing. Others snarled and were all too well assured of themselves. This particular dog was like a small hound, with long drooping ears of a white and liver color. A beagle, probably, although he did not know much about breeds of dogs. It stood at a safe distance of 10 feet, looked at him, wagged its tail, and whimpered just audibly.
"Go away,"
he said roughly, for his heart was suddenly bitter within him, and he felt himself building a wall against more attachments, which must only end with death.
"Go away,"
he repeated. Instead, the dog took a step or two closer to him and put its forequarters down on the ground and laid its head on its forefeet and looked up at him with strangely appealing eyes, which rolled upward. Long drooping ears gave the face an expression of infinite sadness. Obviously, the dog was saying, "You have broken my heart." Suddenly, without thinking, he smiled, and he remembered then it was perhaps the first time he had smiled. Except ironically, since the snake had struck. He came to himself instantly and realized that the dog was rubbing against his leg, quick to sense the change of his mood. As he looked down, it scurried away suddenly in fright, or pretended fright, then dashed around in a little circle variegated with two quick dodges and ended again with its forelegs on the ground and its head between them, giving out an eager little bark, which changed into a hound-like howl. Again, Ish broke into a smile, which this time was really a broad grin, and the dog sensed his mood. It dashed around him again in a swift run, with sudden changes of direction, giving an imitation of what it would do if chasing a rabbit. It ended this little demonstration of varied abilities by running boldly up to Ish's legs again, rubbing against them, and putting its head there as if to be patted, as much as saying, "Wasn't that a good act I put on?" Realizing what was expected of him, Ish dropped his hand on the dog's head and patted the sleek forehead. The dog gave a little whimper of satisfaction. The tail wagged so vigorously that the whole body seemed to be wagging from the ears back. The light-colored eyes rolled upward until the whites showed along the bottom. It was the picture of adoration. The long ears fell on each side and little wrinkles showed on the forehead. The dog was certainly making a good case of love at first sight. Its action said, "This is the only man in the world for me." Ish relaxed suddenly. Squatting down, he patted the dog unashamedly. "Well," he thought, "I've got myself a dog, whether I want one or not." And then he reconsidered. "I mean, the dog has got me." He opened the door of the station wagon. The dog jumped in and lay down at home on the front seat. Going into a grocery, Ish found a box of dog biscuits. He fed the dog one from his hand. The animal took the food without any particular sign of affection or thanks. This was obviously what a man was for. Once you had got yourself a man, there was no need to be particularly grateful to him. Noticing for the first time, Ish saw that it was not a dog, strictly speaking, but a bitch. "Well," he said, "a case of pure seduction, apparently." He went back to the house and picked up a few of his personal belongings, some clothes, his field glasses, a few books. He reflected a moment whether there was anything else needed for a trip which might take him clear across the continent. Then he shrugged his shoulders. He took out his wallet and discovered that he had $19 in fives and ones. He certainly did not need any more money. He even considered throwing the whole wallet away, but finally kept it. He was so used to having it in his hip pocket that he felt uncomfortable without it. The money would probably do him no harm. Without any real hope, he composed a note and left it posted conspicuously on the living room desk. If they should return while he was away, they would know that they should wait for his return or leave a note of their own for him. As he stood by the car, he gave another look up and down San Lupo Drive. There was no one inside, of course. The houses and trees all looked the same as before. But he noticed again that the lawns and gardens already showed the lack of care, particularly of watering. In spite of the fogs, the long drought of the California summer was already settling down. By now it was mid-afternoon. Nevertheless, he decided to start at once. He was anxious to be off, and he could spend the night at some nearby town. As with the dogs and cats, so also with the grasses and flowers which man had long nourished. The clover and the bluegrass withered on the lawns, and the dandelions grew tall. In the flower bed, the water-loving asters wilted and drooped, and the weeds flourished. Deep within the camellias, the sap failed. They would bear no buds next spring. The leaves curled on the tips of the wisteria vines and the rose bushes as they set themselves against the long drought. Foot by foot, the wild cucumbers quickly sent their long vines across lawn and flower bed and terrace. As once, when the armies of the empire were shattered, and the strong barbarians poured in upon the soft provincials, so now the fierce weeds pressed in to destroy the pampered nurslings of man. The staunch motor hummed steadily. He drove the morning of this second day with exaggerated caution, thinking of blowouts and of steering gear or brakes which might suddenly cease to function, and of cattle wandering on the highway. He tried to keep the speedometer needle at 40. But that motor had never been designed to keep a car at such a speed, and he constantly found that he'd slid up to 50 or 60 without realizing it. Yet, even to be moving at all kept him from feeling quite so depressed. Mere change of place was a comfort. Flight itself a solace. Deep within, he knew that all this was because he was temporarily escaping from the necessity of decision. As long as he was merely pulling down the curtain of one landscape behind him and raising that of another in front of him, as long as he was merely driving, he did not need to make plans for the future. To decide how he should live, or even whether he should live. The necessity now was only to decide how he should steer around the next approaching curve. The beagle bitch lay beside him. Now and then she put her head in his lap, but mostly she slept quietly, and her being so close was also a comfort. In the rearview mirror, he never saw a car behind him, but he looked in it occasionally out of habit. In it, he saw the rifle and shotgun on the middle seat behind him, and the back seat piled high with the sleeping bag and the cartons of food. He was like a sailor in his own boat, stocked and ready for emergencies, and he also felt the deep desperation of the solitary survivor of a shipwreck, alone in all the vastness. He followed Highway 99 south through the San Joaquin Valley. Although he drove slowly, he made excellent mileage. He did not have to slow down behind a truck, or to stop for traffic lights, though most of them were still functioning, or to reduce speed for towns. In fact, in spite of his apprehensions, he had to admit that driving Highway 99 under these conditions was much safer than driving it through thick and madly speeding traffic. He saw no man. If he had searched through the towns, he might have found someone, but there was no use of it now. The straggler here or there he might pick up at any time. Now he was searching to see whether some greater remnant might be left somewhere. The broad plain stretched away. Vineyards, orchards, fields of melons, fields of cotton. Perhaps a farmer's eye could have seen that already everything showed neglect and the absence of the hand of man. But to Ish, it all still looked about the same. At Bakersfield, he left 99 and turned toward the winding road over to Hatchaby Pass. Fields gave way to scattered slopes of oaks, and higher still came open park-like stands of thin-foliaged coulter pine. Here, too, there was no one. Yet he did not so much feel the absence of people, for this had always been empty country. He came down the side of the pass on the other end and looked out over the far reaches where the desert began. More sharply than ever, he became apprehensive. Although the sun was still well above the horizon, he stopped at the little town of Mojave and began to make his preparations. To cross those 200 miles of desert, men had carried water in their cars even in the old times. There were stretches where one might have to walk for a full day to reach even a roadside stand if the car went bad. He could take no chances now, when no one would be coming to help him. He found a hardware store. The door was massive and strongly locked, so he smashed a window with the hammer and went in. He took three large canteens and filled them at a faucet from which water was still running, though feebly. He added a gallon jug of red wine from a grocery store. Still, he was not satisfied, and the thought of the desert weighed heavily on him. He drove back along the main street, not just sure what he was seeking, and then his eyes fell on a motorcycle. It was black and white, one of those used by the highway patrol.